Kenosha. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We'll see you next time. Bye, everybody.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jeff Rasmussen, a retired Racine Unified teacher and administrator who currently serves as president of the Racine Area Retired Educators Association, Steve Brown, a retired professor of education leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Manji. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning. I'm Steve Brown, welcoming you into this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD HD. This morning I have two guests. In segment one, my guest will be Nicole Neely, and she's president of Speech First, an organization that looks into First Amendment issues of students, particularly at the university level. And in segment two, my guest is Karen Fisher, a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. And I'm very pleased to welcome into this segment of Education Matters here on WGTD HD, Nicole Neely. And Nicole is president of Speech First, an organization. It's a national organization, and she is the president, and we'll find out more about that organization. Nicole, welcome back to Education Matters here on WGTD.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole, just in case our listeners forgot from the last time you were my guest on the program, why don't you tell us where you grew up, because you did grow up here in the Midwest, just to the south of where we are here in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Sure. I grew up in Deerfield, Illinois, so Lake County, and I went to undergrad at the University of Illinois, so some of your Big Ten neighbors to the south.
Give us some background about how Speech First got started, which stimulated your interest. I know that one of the items on your biography on the website, on the Speech First website, it talks about when you were in college at the U of I at Urbana-Champaign, and kind of relate that to how Speech First got started.
Sure. So I have grown up very passionate about civil liberties my whole life. On my father's side, my family's Japanese, and my grandparents actually met in an internment camp. They met at Manzanar. So I have always been very mindful of the phrase, a government big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take it away, all away, because, well, they did. I went to the University of Illinois. I was a political science major. I was involved in the ACLU in college. I was also involved with the Panhellenic Council. So I was the director of risk management for, at the time, was the biggest Greek system in the country. So I passed out Know Your Rights cards and gave presentations to all the different sororities. It has been interesting to me over the years. Prior to creating Speech First, I used to run a state-level investigative journalism organization. And, you know, to watch the news and hear stories about what was going on campus these days, it struck me that it's so different than the college experience that I remembered. And as I dug into it, I was, you know, more and more horrified. I have small children now, and so it's certainly a concern that you don't want to send your children or your money to schools like that. And so I started telling my alma mater when they would call me, as I'm sure, you know, they call you, you know, your school calls you and many of your listeners' alma maters call them, asking for donations. I would tell them, you know, no, I will not. I'm sorry. I have a problem with how you treat civil liberties on campus these days. And, you know, it's probably some sophomore who's making $10 an hour in a work study, and they'd say, okay, thanks. And they'd hang up. And it struck me that I don't give enough to make this school really care. And there's something that is, you know, really disheartening about that. Keep your $50, you know, have a nice life. But I thought, you know, maybe if there were 100 of me, if there were 1,000 of me, maybe the school would actually listen. And so that was kind of the genesis for the idea of Speech First. I think it's very scary for students, even if they realize that their rights are being violated, which, frankly, a lot of students don't. I think civic literacy is very bad these days. But even if you realize that your rights are being violated, the deck is stacked against you to stand up and actually affect change. At the end of the day, you still want a diploma. And so you'll put up with a lot. And even if you decide, all right, in the face of this, I'm going to deal with the ostracism that will happen, deal with the potential fallout. I know I might not get a good letter of recommendation. Maybe I won't get a scholarship, but I'm going to do the right thing and stand up. Universities still have this very troubling trump card, and that's all they need to do is to wait you out. If a student graduates, transfers, is kicked out, then the courts will say that the harm has gone away. And so really any kind of case that a student brings has to be over, you know, at best 3 or 4 years, if it's a freshman or sophomore. And so schools have leveraged that over the years. And so what is interesting about Speech First is that as a membership association, as long as we always have a student member who is enrolled when we challenge university policies, our cases can go on indefinitely. This is how the Sierra Club litigates. This is how the ACLU does. But we file cases on behalf of our student members who, in our cases, are anonymous. They're listed as student A, student B, student C. So they're not shamed. They're not ostracized. But that we can also, we can stop the clock on that litigation. So that to me is something that's very exciting. And, you know, a new way to take on this challenge of problems in higher education.
What was the first case that you did file and how did that go?
Sure. So the first case we brought was against the University of Michigan. We filed that in May 2018. And that makes my Big Ten heart beat. But Michigan had a series of policies that we felt had both the purpose and the effect of chilling student speech. They had an overbroad speech code, bullying code, that gave administrators broad discretionary power to determine what kind of language worked and what kind of language didn't, and that students would get in trouble for. And unsurprisingly, the kinds of language that would get students in trouble, it was political and it was religious speech. And we also challenged a policy that University of Michigan had called a bias response team. This was something that I was not familiar with prior to creating Speech First. And when I started reading about it, I thought, you know, this is like The Onion. This is a joke. But this is a program. These are programs that hundreds, if not thousands, of schools across the country now have, where on their university websites, on their official websites, they have portals where students are encouraged to report on each other. On many university campuses, you can do so anonymously. But I can go on, I can say, Steve said this thing, I can put my name to it or not. And then you will be contacted by the school. You will not be apprised of your rights. You will not be told it's voluntary. But you will be called in before, I think of it as a bureaucratic star chamber made up of deans of students, provosts, sometimes university police, depending on what the campus is. And you will have to defend your actions. And I mean, bear in mind, the University of Michigan is a public university campus. There is a lot of ugly speech that is still constitutionally protected. And so these programs would call in students. The students would, you know, it's a distraction from their studies. It's terrifying to get that kind of email. They don't have representation with them. And so the student, after they come out, they think, you know, that was a distraction. I don't want to do that again. So not only will that student think twice about before he or she uses the kind of language that maybe got them reported in the first place, they'll tell their friends, and their friends will think twice about expressing those kind of viewpoints. University of Michigan had a very elaborate log of what the kinds of incidents that had been reported. The year before we sued Michigan, there were over 150 incidents of alleged bias. And you know, the website said things like, the most important indication of bias is your own feelings. Bias can be intentional or unintentional. And so students were put in a position where they could get reported and called in for offending someone, even if they didn't mean to. And so that meant that students were in a position where they had to tailor their language as to what the most sensitive student on campus might interpret their remarks to be if they wanted to avoid getting in trouble. I think that's unacceptable. I think that's unconstitutional, and that's why we challenged the policy. We went back and forth at the district court level. We asked for a preliminary injunction. We ended up getting a good ruling this past September from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, where they found that our student members had something called standing, that they were able to challenge the policy, and that the policies did indeed objectively chill student speech. The school had tried to make the lawsuit go away by changing some of the policies. The Sixth Circuit called them out for the disingenuous timing of that change. And so, you know, they tried to make the policy go away through something called mootness. And the Sixth Circuit said that, nope, that was, they called them on that bad behavior. And so I think they were able to send a message to a lot of schools that you can't just, students shouldn't have to play whack-a-mole if there's a bad policy, because schools if they have a bad policy, maybe they'll get sued. They'll get caught with their hand in the cookie jar. They'll change the policy, and then they'll backslide after people are not looking anymore. I think Michigan is a great example of that, because one of the early speech codes that was challenged actually was in 1989 at the University of Michigan. They had one of the original political correctness codes that was struck down. 30 years later, here we are. You are perpetually bad actors. And so just trying to make this go away when people are looking is not something that universities should be able to do. And thanks to the Sixth Circuit, they're on notice that that kind of behavior is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. As you were saying that, you know, I was thinking, and as you know, I teach school law at the graduate level for teachers who want to become school principals and principals who want to become superintendents. And I also serve on a school board. And why is it that most people, or I should say a lot of people, believe that when we talk about issues about freedom of speech and freedom of expression, that is typically thought of as something on the liberal side? And I'm talking about politics now, the liberal side of politics versus either moderate or on the conservative side. Why do you think all that got started as far as how people think about free speech?
Thinking historically through kind of the genesis of the free speech movement, you know, a lot of this started in the 1960s in Berkeley, right? There were students that wanted to protest the Vietnam War. They wanted to advocate for communist causes. Those are definitely left of center. And so it's been very curious to watch all of that flip over the past few years, where, you know, now there is this element of safetyism on campus, where students want to be free from ideas that might cause them emotional harm. I mean, you know, it's what kind of training is that for the real world? The real world is not necessarily a kind and gentle place. And so if students go through 4 years of college coddled and then get out and are ill-prepared for the real world, I think that the universities have done them a disservice. So I think a lot of this starts much earlier. This is not necessarily the fault of the colleges, but to encourage that kind of behavior and that kind of mindset, I think, is a very dangerous and detrimental one, and one that will have significant repercussions for the rest of the country in the future.
What kinds of changes on the college campuses have you seen with regards to student free speech, how professors are dealing with students' points of view, and then how students either pull back on their points of view or just ignore campus policy?
Sure. So we have only been around for about 2.5 years, but just kind of looking, taking a step back and looking at kind of the arc of history. I mean, I remember when I was in college, you know, we had most of my professors, even if you disagreed with them, if you were able to back up your perspective, if you're able to use facts, use data, you know, show your logical, your logic, you were still, you had a fighting chance of getting a good grade. I mean, these days, I think probably the most frequent complaints that I receive from students are, I got a bad grade, I didn't get a letter of recommendation because the teacher disagreed with my ideology, with my viewpoint, which is so sad. I mean, I think about an anecdote that I heard about Thomas Sowell years ago when he was teaching at Stanford. Said he had a student come up to him at the end of the semester and say, what do you believe? I don't know what you think. And Thomas Sowell said that was one of my finest moments as a professor. And it seems to me that those days are long gone. I mean, I think a lot of professors go into teaching now with an eye to, you know exactly where they stand on the issues, and woe betide you if you cross that. When we sued Michigan, one of my students told me that in 2016, his physics professor told the class the day before the election, I hope you all do the right thing and vote for Hillary tomorrow. I mean, what does that have to do with physics? What does that have to do with science?
Sure.
He said the professor saw him the next day wearing a Trump hat and then wouldn't write him a letter of recommendation. He was the department chair. That's the kind of thing that can get you into a better med school if you have somebody who is that well-respected in the field. And so there are real repercussions for students letting their ideology be known. And so I think that's why we see statistics after statistic, polls showing that students are self-censoring at astonishing rates. They are refraining from having conversations about anything controversial, about religion, about politics. When we sued the University of Illinois, my alma mater, one of my student members told me he's afraid to even ask questions about transgenderism, that he doesn't understand, but to not blindly accept that this is okay and to be part of, toe the party line, will get you in trouble. And that is a frightening experience. And that is a frightening environment for for universities where students are supposed to be expanding their horizons and learning new things.
Earlier in July, you wrote an op-ed in Newsweek, and it starts out, amid the current season of activism, young people have enthusiastically taken both to the streets and the internet, participating in the national discussion over race relations in America. And one of the paragraphs that you wrote in that op-ed, which was, and I had read it when it came out, you said there's no room for changing one's mind and no regard for the shifting goalpost of what used to be acceptable. What kinds of things would you say to a new professor in terms of making sure that they listen to what the students have to say and not use that, if you will, and I know no other way of putting it, against them with regards to their point of view?
Students come to campus full of ideas and full of enthusiasm, and some of them have good ideas, some of them have bad ideas, and I think it is incumbent on professors, I've never been a professor as a disclaimer, to channel that and to encourage good habits, okay? That's your opinion, back it up. You are not there to get students to recite talking points, to agree with your worldview. So much of the fun of college is to have those late night debates, to persuade someone. Maybe somebody changes your mind. How many students go to college when they're 18 with a perfectly formed worldview? Pretty much nobody. But now students are in a position where if they have had one wrong, and I put wrong in quotes, idea at some point and it has been written down, I mean, you're in danger of being canceled, for getting in trouble because you said something that somebody now thinks is hateful in 2020. There's no room for personal growth, and that's so sad.
I'm going to quote something else that you wrote in the publication Town Hall, which is it's at townhall.com, which is a conservative website. And they bring together, or pull together, if you will, a lot of political commentary and analyses from many, many columnists and opinion leaders from across the country. You said that the pursuit of truth usually isn't linear. It requires testing hypotheses, rigorous investigation, and skepticism to ensure that conclusions can withstand scrutiny. So my question is, how difficult is it to actually pursue truth nowadays in 2020?
I think it's very hard. I mean, there are obviously topics in academia that are just totally off limits. I mean, issues of gender, issues of race, climate science, right? There are topics that just can't be discussed. They are not up for debate. Someone will equate you with being a Holocaust denier if you hold an opinion outside of, what is orthodoxy on campus. And I think that's unfortunate because you should have colleagues in your department who can push back and say, you know what, have you thought of it this way? Or I thought this was a weak part of your paper. Would you consider, bolstering it? But instead, we now see academic departments at all kinds of universities, big and small, where everybody on the faculty thinks the same. Everybody agrees the same. It's just a everybody patting each other on the back. And I think the quality of scholarship suffers. And that is unfortunate because universities for so long have held this magical place in society. It's not supposed to be a group of yes men. It's not supposed to be clubby. It should be a little bit, adversarial. It should be interesting. People should have different points of view. And that is, one of the reasons that there's tenure is that a professor should be able to pursue crazy ideas and go down research rabbit holes without fear of being fired. Yet, that doesn't happen anymore. Now faculty hiring committees only look for people who think like them. And mm-hmm. What a boring place to work.
You mentioned a bit earlier the word chilling. I found that very interesting. Could you maybe elaborate on when you say that as far as speech is chilled when individuals are refrained from speaking, what you mean by that and maybe give another example?
Sure. I mean, yeah. It is, a legal term, and so that individuals did simply refrain from talking about topics. They self-censor. because they fear disciplinary repercussions. It is sad to me that students are in a position where, because of overbroad speech codes, they don't know what they could be in trouble for. If a school were to ban offensive language or hateful language, who's defining that? I mean, that's like saying a food is delicious. What is delicious to me might not be delicious to you. And so you are at the whim of administrators who will be determining what those words mean. And sadly, I mean, you look at statistics of college administrators' worldviews. Sam Abrams at Sarah Lawrence College has run these numbers. I mean, as much as people complain about the political bent of faculty, it turns out that administrators in many cases are orders of magnitude more ideologically left of center than even professors. And so if somebody who holds that kind of power is picking the kinds of words that you can and cannot say, I think it is a very real and a very rational thing to just refrain from talking about topics so that you don't get crosswise with one of these administrators that holds that kind of power over you. Mm-hmm. And so students just don't talk about topics that might be controversial. And sadly, you know, the window of acceptable discourse on so many college campuses these days is so narrow, and it is shifting very far left. That even what has been interesting to me is to look at polls where even self-identified Democratic students censor themselves, because I think it's hard to keep track with what is acceptable and what is not from day to day. Looking at, 6 or 8 years ago, I think people forget that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama used to be opposed to gay marriage. So the statements they made in 2012, 2011 would certainly get you canceled today. I mean, for, you know, much far lesser transgressions. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that people are not able to evolve their views, to change their minds at all, strikes me very strange that, you know, people are frozen in time. You are always held accountable for what you said in your weakest moment or in your darkest hour. I think that's a very impossible standard to hold others to. And it's not something that we would want to be held to ourselves.
The First Amendment, I'll just read a portion of the First Amendment, says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech. And when it says Congress, it's obviously talking about the government. And and what I'd like to do is shift to, what about private schools, private businesses? And I just want to lead in, if we could, about, I know one of the projects of Speech First is your private school petition project. And maybe if you could talk a bit about that, and then maybe talk about what happened at DePaul University down in Chicago a few years ago, and relate that to a letter that you wrote recently to the president at DePaul University.
Sure. So yes, the First Amendment applies to state actors. So that would be a state school. That would be the University of Illinois. It would be Iowa State University, University of Michigan. So they have to uphold the First Amendment. They are not able to discriminate against students on the basis of their speech and the content of what they want to say. Private schools, however, are a little bit different. Private schools enjoy freedom of association. They're allowed to set their own rules. And some private schools are very clear about that. I got my master's degree from Pepperdine University in California. Pepperdine makes no bones about putting the tenets of their faith above all else. It's spelled out in their student code. There was a giant 200-foot Golden Cross on campus. You know what you're getting into. Just like when you go to Brigham Young, if you go to Yeshiva University, mm-hmm. You know what you're getting yourself into. Where I think it gets a little bit more complicated is private schools that pretend like they uphold the freedom of speech. Maybe their student handbook says that they respect and uphold freedom of speech, freedom of expression, yet then they also have policies that don't adhere to that. So DePaul University is one of those schools. A few months ago, we launched a petition project to try and flag for the school, as well as for alumni and current students, that DePaul preaches one thing, yet practices another. DePaul has a terrific set of guiding principles for speech and expression, but instead, what they do is they have kicked speakers off campus, they have canceled events, they have charged security fees for speakers, they have a free speech zone. So a number of policies really that run extremely contrary to this wonderful, and it's a great policy on paper, yet they're not upholding that in practice. And so I think you know, we're not going to sue a private university again. The private university has this, they were able to set their own rules. But I think that kind of dichotomy is, if I were a parent looking where I might send my child in the fall, that would be of interest to me. If I were a current student, I'd be a little bit appalled that my school was doing, was trying to have it both ways. And if I were an alumni, I'd be disappointed, and I would, frankly, I'd stop giving. I would expect more from my alma mater. And so we wanted to do that and see if we could maybe exercise a little bit of, you know, public pressure to see if the school would voluntarily change their policies, because, you know what, I can't force the school to do that. So we had a petition open up. We had signature. We had people from all over the country sign, alumni, current students, just people like you and me who are First Amendment lovers who are disappointed that this is how some schools are acting. Mm-hmm. We sent it to DePaul University. Unfortunately, DePaul University did not respond, but to me, that is an interesting data point. Again, if I were to be considering where I might send my child in the fall, the fact that DePaul had these issues flagged to them and didn't respond, that would be tremendously concerning to me. And so I think, you know, we'll continue to try and hold other private schools accountable. We have a plan to roll out some of these in the fall as well, because sadly there are many, many private schools across the country that practice one thing and preach another.
As you look at the future, what kinds of new projects or cases or direction do you see Speech First headed?
Sure. This the spring was a little bit of a strange spring, obviously because of COVID. We had to delay filing the lawsuit that we had planned because students weren't on campus. So we're keeping an eye on what the fall semester is going to look like, if students will be around or not. In the meantime, we've actually started to get involved in Title IX issues. In May, the Trump administration released long-awaited revisions to federal Title IX policy, Title IX governing sex discrimination in federally funded schools. We, unsurprisingly, saw that a number of liberal organizations and Democratic attorneys general from across the country, once the rules came out, sued the administration to block the rules, asked for a nationwide injunction. And so we got involved. We intervened in, so far we've intervened in 3 of the 4 lawsuits, and we have had intervention granted in 2 of the 4. We're about to file the 4th papers. Because we believe that not only are these rules good policy, but that they are constitutionally required. And we wanted to bring the voices of our student members into the courtroom. These are students who have had their rights violated by the previous interpretation of sexual harassment, by how schools have been using due process or not using due process. And so we wanted to make sure that the court considered those voices and those perspectives as they look to uphold or to enjoin the new Title IX rules. So I think that's exciting because in my mind, a lot of the bad speech policies on campus have flown from Title IX overreach. So I think it's, in many ways, taking on Title IX and having these new Title IX rules is almost like cutting off Medusa's head. So we're optimistic and we look forward to fighting on in federal court on those fronts.
I want to close with a quote which usually is attributed to Voltaire, but was actually written by Evelyn Beatrice Hall, who was a French author and humanist back in the late 1600s and into the 1700s, when she wrote, "I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it." You know, it's easy to utter those words. Okay, "I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it." If you were to take all those words and look at where we are today, do you think that quote would have any standing across our country, from the East Coast to the West Coast and here in the Midwest?
Fortunately, not. I mean, I see so many people who are of the mindset that if what you were saying hurts my feelings, offends me, you should not say it. You should be censored. You should be shamed. You should be drummed out of polite society. And that's so sad to me because, I mean, I think I live near Skokie, Illinois, which is the site of, in 1977, the Nazis tried to march through what is a Jewish suburb, and the ACLU stepped up and defended that. A lot of the students that we represent have views on politics that I disagree with vehemently, but I think those views are not outside the realm of, you know, polite society. I think there are, you know, millions of Americans that have them, and those views should be aired on college campuses. I think listeners should be able to listen to both sides of an argument and make up their minds for themselves. I used to run a women's organization, and nothing irks me more than somebody trying to take, you know, decide for me what I can and can't do. And so, and to me, that's what a lot of these campus censors want to do. They want to decide for others what you can and cannot hear. And that to me is, that's arrogant and condescending. Maybe I want to listen to someone like Milo Yiannopoulos because I want to hear what his best points are so that I can meet them with my own. But to deny somebody of the opportunity to hear somebody's speech that they hate is so small-minded and so, you know, it does a disservice to everybody involved. Because frankly, muzzling somebody doesn't change their mind. It doesn't make their viewpoints go away. It doesn't persuade them. It just drives their views underground, you know, to the dark recesses of the internet, where they just find echo chambers of their own. And I think that's far more dangerous than having something be aired in public. And yes, let's subject all ideas to a thorough examination and in the pursuit of truth. That's a far more noble aim.
If someone wanted to find out more about Speech First, how would they do so?
Our website is speechfirst.org. Membership is open not only to students, but also to concerned citizens, parents, grandparents, alumni, people who love the First Amendment, and it is only $5. We're also on all the traditional social media channels, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. So check us out. There are many issues around the country that we keep an eye on, that we comment on, in addition to our various lawsuits against both universities, as well as at this point, a bunch of state attorneys general. So sadly, there is a lot of work to be done. So we welcome everyone to our corner.
Nicole Neely, I want to thank you once again for being my guest here on Education Matters, talking about Speech First. And hopefully, if anyone has any additional questions, they can contact your organization at speechfirst.org. And again, thank you so much, Nicole.
Thank you.
And we continue now with this segment of Education Matters here on WGTD. I'm very pleased to welcome into this segment Karen Fisher, who is a senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. She covers the business of international education, including competition for foreign students, activities by colleges overseas, and also programs that affect international activities. Karen, welcome to Education Matters.
Well, thanks for having me.
Karen, I was particularly interested in your article that appeared in the Chronicle recently with the headline, or the title rather, The Diversity Conversation Colleges Aren't Having. And I thought we would talk about that this morning. But before we do that, one of the things I always like to do with guests here on Education Matters, if you could maybe share with our audience something about yourself, your background, where you grew up, where you went to school, and how you got involved with the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Sure. I am happy to do that. I grew up actually in Canada and came to the U.S. to go to school. I went to Smith College in Massachusetts, so very much a traditional liberal arts college curriculum. I majored in political philosophy. And so I didn't study journalism. I'm a little bit of an accidental higher education reporter. I actually was a political reporter and was covering Congress, and came to the Chronicle of Higher Education actually to cover politics and policy in the states. So all those fights over funding of higher education, and but it, you know, it's kind of a little bit of a misnomer, because it's almost anything that happens with public universities and colleges. And after a couple of years, I changed my primary focus in my job to cover international education, and I've been doing that for a number of years now.
If we could talk about your article, The Diversity Conversation Colleges Aren't Having, and then also, before we end our conversation today, if we could also talk about COVID-19 because I know you do some coverage on that as well. What led you to writing this article, The Diversity Conversation Colleges Are Not Having?
Well, the focus of the article is about the protests, the Black Lives Matter protests, and how colleges are thinking, or in many cases not thinking, about international students in those that educational process. They're not thinking necessarily about the different ways that diversity plays out in different countries and cultures. And the story was sparked by the protest, but in all honesty, it's something I've been thinking about for a long time. I spent a lot of time on college campuses talking with international students. And while there are lots of different hurdles that they are having to adjust to in coming to the United States, one of the things that they wouldn't often say explicitly, but I would notice, is just how they began thinking about race, and their how many of them comprehended race and racial identity coming here. And in some cases, it was very much sort of shaped by American popular culture. In other cases, it was very much a reflection of their home country's cultures. And I think that a lot of students coming to the United States almost were looking for some sort of roadmap or guide to figure out how to talk about these issues when they were either occurring on their campus, or as with these recent protests after the death of George Floyd, happening in the broader culture here in the U.S. And so that was kind of the genesis of
it. It was interesting in your article that you cite a number of stories from some of the students at a number of colleges and universities. In particular, you open with some comments and sort of the story of Kwame Gale, who came to McAllister College from Jamaica. One of the things that really jumped out at me is when he said, "I cringe now thinking of himself when he was 18. He says at the beginning, he didn't understand why some of his American classmates of color were angry. When you were interviewing him, what kinds of other thoughts did he share with you in terms of coming to the U.S. and dealing with these sorts of issues that he had not experienced before when he was back in his home country of Jamaica?
Sure. I mean, Kwame had come here, and in the Jamaican context, he would say now that he does see racism or colorism, that is discrimination based on the color of your skin, but he hadn't really thought through it very much. And I think he also had a very cursory understanding, as did many of the students I talked to, about race in the U.S. And like many of the students I talked to, he had this notion that, you know, there had been, say, in the 1960s, the civil rights protests, and that discrimination and that racial divisions had kind of ended, that they were in the past. And so when he says he was cringing, it was because he realized in hindsight that he hadn't fully understood kind of the racial history and the divisions and the discrimination that many of his American classmates were experienced and had experienced. And he said it wasn't actually until he went to not just to the United States, but that he studied abroad his junior year. He went to South Africa, a place where obviously issues of racial discrimination are really still kind of front and center. And that understanding and seeing what happened there, he said, really helped him understand more and reflect on what he was experiencing in the United States. And it also helped give him a way to talk about it that I think he hadn't had when he first came to the U.S. as an 18-year-old.
As you put this article together, you also draw into it discussions and interviews with students and administrators, particularly here in the Midwest. I know you did an interview with Charisse Bunn, who is Assistant Director for International Student Engagement at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And you draw reference to I guess what a lot of people have called and continue to call social justice 101 sessions. First of all, how would you define what universities are calling these social justice sessions that they're having now?
Both the University of Wisconsin and the University of Michigan, I think, are ahead of other campuses in thinking explicitly about how to kind of bring international students up to speed on issues of race and racial identity. And so they've built in programming and they've put staffers in place who deal with international students whose focus is more broadly on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And one of the issues is that just the way universities are structured, you know, there are these different offices and they don't often talk to each other. And so you're not thinking about how to bridge those gaps or those divides. And in terms of exactly what the kinds of programming might happen, I mean, at some campuses, you know, they have workshops during freshman orientation, or they have lunch sessions over the course of the semester that just are basic 101. Here, let's talk a little bit about what does some of this terminology mean? What are some key points about race and racial history in the United States? So sometimes they're very sort of, here's what you need to know, here's some shorthand, here's a quick primer on these things. But other times it's almost, it can be a safe space to talk. I mean, a number of the students that I spoke to said, we have a lot of questions, but you don't want to just go up to, you know, your Black American classmate and pepper that person with questions and make them have the responsibility to teach you about race. And so sometimes these kinds of sessions can really just be a place to raise questions or to talk about, okay, I'm coming from this country and here's my experience with race. And sometimes for these students, it's actually about reckoning with being seen and being given a racial identity once they're in the United States. Both students like Kwame from Jamaica, but also even students from China, you know, come from more racially homogenous places, and they've not thought about their own personal identity in terms of race, but yet they come here to the United States, and that's how people see them. They see you're Black or you're Asian, and so sometimes these students are dealing with what does it mean now that I'm here in America, and people, this is the lens through which people see me. And sometimes programming on campus can help students.
I always like to ask at the very end, is there anything I didn't ask that I should have asked about either the article we were talking about or anything else that you're working on?
I mean, I would just say one thing quickly, which is that, and this is not so much you're not asking the question, but perhaps me not thinking about it this way. One of the reasons that it's important to talk about this is if one of the reasons that students come here is to understand, sort of to have a fully American education, a fully American experience, if there's not the sort of infrastructure in place to help them be part of that conversation when it's kind of all around us these days, it's on the news every night, and it's you know, it's the thing that I think students are going to be talking about when they return to campus, if they return to campus in the fall. I think it probably does a disservice to the international students not to have them be part of the conversation, but I also think that the broader college is missing out on something. If one of the reasons that we bring students to the United States to study is because they offer this diversity of viewpoints and perspectives, then what better time when we have this issue that's so dominating American life and American culture to have those extra additional outside perspectives in that conversation? It just seems like a real missed opportunity if on both counts.
Karen Fisher, senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, I want to thank you so much for taking your time to talk with me and to talk about the work that you do. And hopefully we can have you back in the future here on Education Matters.
Well, thanks. I enjoyed the conversation.
I'm Steve Brown. Thanking you so much for joining me this morning for Education Matters. In segment one, my guest was Nicole Neely. And in segment two,